Yes, hello. Is this machine recording? What's up? I'm Jason Louvre, and this is the 20th episode of the long-suffering Ultra Culture podcast, long missing in action while I've been finishing up and then promoting my book, John Dee and the Empire of Angels. And now to start recording on a very, very frequent basis. So finally, after all of this effort working on this book, which is just a tremendous amount of work, a lot more than I expected, I can finally get back to doing podcasts, doing blogging, doing video, and I'm going to be doing a lot more of that, including doing a lot more teaching at magic.me. So let me just update you on where I've been, and then I have some news that I want to talk about, some sad news, unfortunately. And then this episode is an interview with Mitch Horowitz, who is the author of One Simple Idea about the popularity of positive thinking and the New Thought movement, which is a much, much deeper and more interesting field of esoteric study, if you will, than I actually previously expected. And I've actually gotten very, very interested in this recently. And Mitch is a great authority, perhaps the authority on the subject right now. He's also the author of Occult America, which is a history of the kind of esoteric movements and secret societies and faith revivals that have really marked America as an occult country. Certainly a country that's been shaped by faith, by outsider faith, by dissenter faith, going all the way back to the founding of the country. So Mitch and I had a great conversation recently, just a few days ago, actually at the Philosophical Research Society in Los Angeles, which is Manly P. Hall's old digs. It's this huge library and auditorium that was built by Manly Hall in the 1930s, and that he gave, you know, lectures at on a very, very regular basis. Manly Hall, of course, is the author of The Secret Teachings of All Ages, which is one of the great encyclopedias of the occult, one of the great standby books that people have been turning to learn about esoteric spirituality for decades, almost a century at this point. So Mitch and I had a great conversation, and we will get into that shortly. So let me just update you real quick on what's been going on. So John Dee and the Empire of Angels came out 3 weeks ago. It's only been 3 weeks, which is crazy, after 3 years of work. And it did phenomenally so far, which is thanks to you. And everyone who follows me on the mailing list and the podcast and the video and on my YouTube channel and on the Ultra Culture blog and my various other writing activities, I'm very, very touched by this. And I really mean that. I mean, this is a book that I spent, you know, a big chunk of my life on. It's a very obscure subject. I mean, John Dee and Enochian magic. This is not, you know, something that's at the top of everyone's minds in the news on a day-to-day basis. So to be honest with you, I was very unsure for a lot of the time writing that book that people were going to be interested. I mean, we're in a situation certainly in Western culture, where people are just starting to get interested in the very, very first steps of magic. You know, what's it like if maybe I meditate for 5 minutes? You know, what's a sigil? All right, people are just getting their heads around sigils still. You know, witchcraft, you know, people are getting interested in the very, you know, the early stages of magical pursuit, which is great and awesome. And of course, that's going to have to be the way that it is at a cultural level. Not everyone is going to go into the deep end, and that's okay. But to write a book about John Dee and Enochian, which is really the far reaches of the occult. I mean, I've been saying frequently that, you know, if sigils and meditation are the arithmetic of magic, and then perhaps Kabbalah and Golden Dawn are the geometry, and maybe something like Crowley's Thelema is the trigonometry, well, then Enochian is calculus. And so to write essentially a massive history and textbook on Enochian, that was, you know, I was very skeptical that people were going to be interested in that in a mass way, but you are. And you have been, and the book was number one bestseller in all three of its categories. That's magic studies, occultism, and philosopher philosopher biographies. So my biography of Dee was outselling Nietzsche, Kant, and the Buddha. So there you go. And I think it went up to somewhere around 550 on Amazon overall, which is pretty damn good for certainly for an occult book. So I'm really happy about this. I'm very touched by this. And this really had everything to do with you and not as much to do with me in the sense that you took a chance on it and you picked up the book and the reviews have been amazing. Everyone is very, very happy with the book. I think across the board. So knock on wood, I think we got a winner. Okay. So I've also been on kind of a blitzkrieg marketing tour for the last 2 months where I've been doing nothing but people's podcasts and speaking and video interviews basically every day. I went to Seattle 2 weeks ago to speak at Mortlake and Company, which is a great esoteric bookstore in downtown Seattle, and did a great, had a great reception there. The place was packed. People showed up to talk about D and Enochian, and the talk from that has actually been put up on YouTube. If you go to the magic.me YouTube channel, and then the course part where I actually took people into the 30th Enochian Aether is now uploaded to magic.me as a course, which is called Entering the Enochian Universe, which is kind of the master class in Enochian. And people have been very, very happy with that as well. So I've been pretty busy and I've been pretty exhausted. I mean, I think promoting a book is probably just as much work as writing it. And that's probably going to be going on for a while. But in addition to this, I really want to get this podcast back going because I really enjoy podcasting. I think it's a great way to talk to you on a one-to-one basis, on a hopefully at least a weekly basis, maybe more, and keep everyone updated on what's going on. Not as much with not just with me, but with magic and the world in general. And I want to have, get back to interviewing people and, talking to, there's lots of exciting thinkers in this space just coming up also. I already have a bunch of interviews lined up. That's going to be great. But I also want to just have this as a forum to talk to you and keep connected and keep up on what's happening in the world. So this week something very sad happened in our world, which I want to take a moment to talk about also before we get to the interview with Mitch. And that is that Adam Parfrey died. So Adam Parfrey was the, it's upsetting even to have to say, was next to Adam, who's a great friend of mine. Adam was the publisher and editor and captain of Feral House Press, which, of course, if you're not aware, has been one of the primary publishing houses, certainly in the counterculture and also in the occult world. And really, Adam was out there for decades on the very outer fringes of culture, kind of agitating from the sidelines and also just pushing our world forward, our kind of world of, misfit, strange, very smart weirdos. So Adam, was a great friend and supporter and mentor to a lot of people. And his passing leaves is, first of all, his passing incredibly unexpected. He was 61, very young to die. He died suddenly, or he fell ill suddenly and then died about a week later. I had was aware that that was going to happen, but it didn't make it any easier when I got the news that he had passed. That's the last thing I expected to hear. I had expected Adam to be around for a long time, and Adam has always been there. And kind of we've, everyone in the counterculture, I think, has kind of relied on Adam without even knowing it, and just to be there, to be Adam, to hold that place in the culture, to kind of keep the tent propped up, as it were. And he was a great, he was a tent builder, and someone who built a big tent and was very generous with people and took chances on people, including me, that nobody else would take a chance on, published material that no other publishers would touch. I mean, Adam, some of his, he did so many books at Feral House. Some of the ones you may have heard of course, Lords of Chaos, which is the book about the black metal scene in Scandinavia in the 90s, and Euronymous and all of that stuff. He did the book that was turned into the Ed Wood movie, and his, you know, his most famous one, the one he started with, was called Apocalypse Culture, which I'll talk about in a second. That was that he did in the 80s. So Adam, in many ways, was the internet before the internet for guys like me. I mean, Adam, you know, before the web happened, it was very, very hard to get, I mean, basically impossible to get information on anything outside of the mainstream narrative. I mean, you got to remember in the 80s, there were what? I mean, like less than 10 channels, if you were lucky, if you had cable. Otherwise, you had broadcast. I mean, you know, the edgiest thing that people, the edgiest thing that people, you know, had to consume was like Dallas, right? You know, there was no Amazon. If your local library didn't carry books on, you know, weird stuff, which usually they didn't, then you were out of luck, you know. And it was a time in the U.S. that was very much dominated by the Christian right, where Dungeons and Dragons was the most controversial thing. And people would come down, you know, in fury on anyone who was playing Dungeons and Dragons. We had the Satanic Panic, where, you know, like people were terrified that there were Satanists everywhere that were, you know, like sacrificing children or some craziness like that, because they just didn't have access to information. They didn't, they didn't know. They couldn't go Google it and check on the internet whether these things were real or not. So they were still living in, you know, a bubble of media poverty and a bubble of lack of information, and a lot of, you know, bad information spread in that context. You know, and like, I remember when people were just getting into the occult, for instance, I mean, you had to really, really hunt for, let's say, a Crowley book, right? I mean, that was exceedingly rare to find. Most libraries did not and still do not carry Crowley books because they get stolen, right? So, you know, Adam came into that environment and decided to break the media stranglehold in a way, and just kind of inject the craziest material that he could find into the culture. I mean, Adam was he's kind of an avatar of Loki in a way, you know, a great trickster. We both went to the same school, UC Santa Cruz. Adam dropped out of UC Santa Cruz after, I think, his first semester. I remember reading somewhere that, you know, he was just sick of seeing, you know, interacting with other students who were bragging about their new stereos that they bought with their student loans and things like that. Of course, UC Santa Cruz is a great incubator of weirdos and always has been. And Adam took what remained of his student loan in the 80s and set up Feral House, which at that point was really the only, you know, publisher that strange, and he just took it on himself to publish the weirdest stuff that he could find, a lot of which he found working at the Strand Bookstore in New York, which used to be in Union Square. Also, the Strand Bookstore is very sadly closed, along with a lot of independent bookstores, although that said, independent bookstores are also making a resurgence, which is great. So Adam's first big book, which had a tremendous impact on me as well, was called Apocalypse Culture, and it came out in, I believe, 1990. And, you know, I think anyone who's been around the counterculture has probably encountered this book at some point. But if you haven't, it was kind of an anthology of the most extreme material that Adam could find. And, you know, there was just insanity in there. This is like pure edgelordery. But a lot of it was focused on, you know, this kind of pre-millennial apocalypticism that was, I mean, we were 10 years to Y2K. It was kind of this very end of the world vibe stuff. But that was the first book that I heard about Jack Parsons in. It was actually the first book, I think it was the first book that I heard about Genesis Peorage in, because there were, there was some content related to Jen or Jen's daughters, I think, that was in that book. And so that was one of the first places I heard about Jen from, who later became my, you know, my magical mentor for almost, you know, many, many years. And then, of course, Adam later published the first biography of Jack Parsons. I mean, without Adam, we wouldn't have been exposed to a lot of this information. Now, Apocalypse Culture was an incredibly disturbing book. I remember being just like scarred by it, which I actually talked about on a recent podcast with Feral House. I remember reading it in my senior year of high school, and I had it in my backpack, and I was kind of like passing it around to other kids in math class to shock them. And I very distinctly remember one girl that I showed it to, you know, probably just to seem edgy and score points, which was not the greatest strategy, saying something like, you know, there's some books you look at that just scar your mind. It's like a razor blade in your brain. It'd be a good blurb for the book. But that's how shocking apocalypse culture was. And remember, this is before the internet. It's before 4chan. And Adam kind of was the one-man chan before the internet. So I think as time went on, Adam progressed from pure shock value to, you know, he really, really cared about the material that he was putting out, and the quality of the material that he was putting out was excellent, both in terms of what he found and the production quality that went into the books. And so I actually later, you know, I was very marked by that book, and I later ended up working for Adam. And Adam became my boss and also a mentor. And that was in, I think, probably between 2006 and 2008. And that was probably the lowest period of my life. I had lost my job in New York, where I'd gone straight out of school to work in the publishing industry. I'd lost my job. This was after Generation Hex came out, my first book, and I had really gone into a very, very dark period where, you know, magically speaking, for the last probably 5, 6, 7 years of my magical practice, I had totally focused on, you know, the light side and the light side of Hermeticism. And I'd gotten to a point where I felt like I had kind of mastered that, and I was just purely kind of white light, you know, very, you know, just trying to be a conduit for the light and happy, hippie, all is love. Everything's going to be great. We're all in this together. It's all going to work out. You know, everyone's coming to consciousness. Everyone's waking up. You know, this is kind of the, a lot of times with people who first get into magic, you know, that's what they get first. But I had decided after my first book came out that I felt so strong in that, that I wanted to see if I could take it into the darkest places imaginable and still maintain that, you know, that perception of the divinity of everything. And so in my case, that involved just a lot of work with the Cliffoth and the Tunnels of Set, you know, as Kenneth Grant writes about. And I wanted to go into the abyss and see if I could get across the abyss and go through the worst parts of magic imaginable. I mean, the Tunnels of Set and the Cliffoth are like the inversion and the reversion of the light side of magic. And it's not even the dark side. It's the broken side. It's all of the broken parts of reality, the things that don't work, the things that go wrong, the things that are mutated and perverse. And, you know, this is certainly not something I recommend repeating. I didn't get, you know, well, let me just say what happened. I mean, I went full on into this. I was doing, you know, cliffotic workings with a partner and things like this, sex magical workings. And my life completely fell apart. I lost my job. I lost all my physical possessions. I ended up moving from New York to Vancouver, British Columbia, for a girl who basically decided, you know, she didn't want a relationship within a month of me getting there. And then I ended up kind of living on the very outskirts of the suburbs in Vancouver, just in the middle of nowhere, you know, with nothing, with kind of two guys who were in a similar position. And it was almost like a halfway house set up. And I had nothing. I had, you know, a few clothes. I had a few books. I'd lost all my physical possessions. And I was so depressed that I could barely get out of bed. So during this time, which thankfully I got out of, you know, it took a lot of doing, and it was a real abyss moment, you know, as we sometimes have a dark night of the soul moment, as sometimes happens in magic. During this period, Adam Parfrey was really the only person keeping me off the street. And that was because he had hired me as a freelance copy editor, and not for a ton of money, because there's, you know, nobody gets into publishing for money, but enough to pay rent and eat within reason, you know. So without Adam, I probably would have been on the street at this point. And so he kind of was the only thing keeping me afloat, you know, which is so I owe a great debt to Adam. But we worked on a ton of books together, including Secret Agent 666 by Richard Spence about the Crowley's intelligence career. We worked on Cholo Style about lowrider culture in California and the Southwest. We worked on Love, Fear, Sex, Death about the Process Church and Timothy Wiley, and a ton of stuff. And I ended up working on more occult material. And then out of that, Adam also published The Psychic Bible, which I'd been editing with Genesis Peerage, which took, you know, it was about a 5-year project of me editing Jen's archives and the archives of the Temple of Psychic Youth into one massive Bible. And he took a chance on that book when nobody else would. You know, that book then became a big seller. It's now worth a lot. You know, and actually, topically this week, Grimes is a big fan of that book and posted about it on social media a couple of years ago. So if you're good at vibing, maybe send some vibes in the way of a future in which Grimes gives Elon Musk a copy of that book. I think we all might want to see what that future looks like. So send some positive vibes in that way if you're a vibey kind of person. But to get back to Adam published this book when nobody else would. So, and I wrote the introduction to that book in a Starbucks, on the outskirts of Vancouver, just in the abyss, you know, in the abyss of hallucinations. And I think it's probably better for that. You know, it comes from a purely vulnerable place, I think. But I continued, you know, I came back to New York, I continued to work for Adam, and then I went into I got a job in advertising to keep myself, you know, try and get out of the gutter. I continued to do some work for Adam when I came to LA even. And so we continued our working relationship. And then when I wasn't working with him, you know, I could always count on Adam to be there, you know, kind of trolling my page on Facebook, or, you know, he was a great, you know, mischief maker online. And kind of, you know, one of the best parts about being on Facebook, he'll be very missed. You know, I got to catch up with him at the last Esoteric Book Conference in Seattle and kind of hang out. And it was the last time I saw Adam. You know, last time I saw Adam was I was hanging out with him and my friend Hannah Haddix. And I walked to a convenience store with Adam in Seattle, and we just bought some, you know, some basic drinks and snacks. And I got that one last time to kind of talk with him one to one. And it felt, that moment felt strangely personal and vulnerable. And like I was interacting with Adam as a, just as a friend. And it felt strangely important just to take that walk with him to the convenience store. And that was maybe, I don't know, maybe a year ago now, but that was the last time I saw Adam. And now he's gone. So what can we learn? I think that for me, it is amazing. I think it's a lesson that all people learn continually, how transitory life is and how fleeting it can be, and how somebody that you think will be there forever, well, you can wake up one day and they're not there. And it's a reminder to cherish the moments we have with everyone and be compassionate and kind as much as we can, because we never know what people are going through and we never know how long people have. And life is very vulnerable and very, very precious. So I think for me personally, it's a reminder of that. It's a reminder to be careful how we interact with people. And I think it's a reminder to me also, and a call to me. I mean, I just see this, and you know, one of my friends said it's like we've lost our captain, or we've lost another captain on the ship of the counterculture, which is a very, very fragile thing. And so I think for me personally, it's also a call. It's a reminder to me that I need to keep stepping up and I need to keep doing what I can to keep this going. And so in that sense, I'm very grateful for all the people who are part of my extended tribe, you know, online. So it's also a reminder to me of how seriously we need to take what we're doing, right? I mean, Adam Parfrey is a guy who dedicated his life to getting, you know, crazy information out and dedicated his life to being against the system and the thorn, you know, a thorn in the side of the system and counterculture to the end. And I have great respect for him for that. Now, when I was 21 or 22, I came up with the word ultraculture. And what I meant with ultraculture is that I'm not satisfied with just being counterculture. And I've never seen myself as a purely counterculture thing. You know, I don't think that the culture, you know, let me put it this way. I don't have enough respect for the culture, the mainstream culture, to spend my life defining myself in opposition to it. Right. I don't think that, and I don't think that there is a monolithic culture anymore. You know, there was in the 50s and 60s when the baby boomers rebelled against the mainstream culture, but now it's, what is it? It's transitory. It's fragmentary. It's disassociated. It's dispersed. It's all over the place. There is no mainstream culture. So what is the counterculture? What is it in opposition to? You know, the moorings have gone. The ship is adrift. And so I coined the phrase ultraculture because all of these ideas with magic and all of this are, in my opinion, superior to the mainstream culture and should be dominant and should be dominant ideas. And so I don't want to be counterculture. I want to be ultraculture. I want to be above the mainstream narrative and better than. That doesn't mean better than specific people. That doesn't mean that I'm seeing myself as better than other people. Far from it, you know. You know, far from it. But in the sense that I think that these ideas are important enough that they shouldn't be relegated to the ghetto. They shouldn't be, you know, the ideological ghetto. They shouldn't be the province of, you know, people in, you know, Slipknot t-shirts and that type of thing. They should have their place. And I think that's happening. And I think that, you know, I've spent 20 years making it happen. And it's happening now. And we need to keep making it happen. And keep building and integrating our culture and our tribe and pushing it forward. And I think, you know, I think that's happening. And I think that I'm going to keep doing, I know that I'm going to keep doing my part to make it happen. And I know that a lot of people listening to this will too, for which I'm very grateful. Okay, so that's a long-winded opener. But I wanted to say what I had to say about Adam, and you know I'm gonna miss him a lot, and you know just to, the idea that I can't get on Facebook and see whatever Adam's latest sarcastic comment was is kind of crushing. But onward we go. Okay, so lots of love to you. I will be making lots more podcasts soon, and you're gonna be hearing a lot more from me. All right, so without further ado, let's introduce you to Mitch Horowitz, and definitely. In the meantime, please follow me on Twitter @JasonLouv. You can follow me on Instagram @Magic.me. Follow me on Facebook, Jason Louv, and definitely sign up for the podcast on iTunes. Subscribe to the YouTube channel. It's just called Magic.me. And last but not least, if you're not on the mailing list, please get on the mailing list. And to get on the mailing list, all you have to do is sign up for our free one-week course in magic, which is full of free podcasts and videos and guided meditations and all kinds of goodies. And all you have to do to do that is actually just take out your cell phone and text the word shaman, S-H-A-M-A-N, to the phone number 44222. So it's the word shaman to the phone number 44222. It'll ask you for your email, give it your email, and then it will send you that 7-day course on magic, which is awesome. and you'll be on the mailing list, and we'll be able to stay in touch through there. Okay, so lots of love to you, and without further ado, here is Mitch Horowitz. Mitch, what's up?
How you doing, man?
Good. It's good to finally meet you.
Likewise. Glad to be here in LA.
Yeah, and we're sitting here in Manly P. Hall's office.
Can you believe it?
It's at the Philosophical Research Society in LA. It's amazing. And you've been on a whirlwind tour. You've been speaking back to back.
Yeah, right? It's been quite a day. Giving talks, shooting a documentary, and dealing with a whole bunch of folks that I don't see enough of. I love Los Angeles. It feels like a second home. I want to pitch a tent on the property and stay here.
I really feel like Los Angeles is kind of like the great occult city in a way, because it has such this history with, you know, Manly Hall and Masonry and New Thought. And I really feel like the city was built by people who wanted to take things out of the imagination and make them real.
Well, there was such a freshness here, and there still is, I think, when people began to migrate to Southern California en masse in the early 20th century. You know, they left behind old ties, old congregations, old churches, old memberships, and they were just up for anything new. And when artists and intellects bubbled up in this city, you know, ranging from Raymond Carver to Manly Hall to Charlie Chaplin to Jiddu Krishnamurti, there were whole groups of people who were willing to dedicate resources to support them. And I want to see that happening everywhere. You know, we need people of means who are willing today in the here and now to support research into ESP and psychedelics and comparative religion and life after death. You know, I don't want there just to be these historical sites, precious as they are, but we have to keep dedicating resources to these things. And Los Angeles residents were willing to do that. And that's why the city is the great place that it is.
Right. One of the things that you've really been a champion of in your work is what you were just saying. I mean, the whole idea of the forward push of the human spirit and the human imagination, and the idea of how can we engage in these ideas, you know, all the stuff that I'm fascinated with, mm-hmm. mysticism, psychedelics, positive thinking. Mm-hmm. And it's been shocking to me how resistant people are to those ideas. Mm-hmm. And people, you know, particularly now, you know, in our current moment, mm-hmm. people are so willing to take the easy way and sink into cynicism and fear and doubt and chaos and focusing on the horrible things that are going on in the world. And there's lots to focus on if you put your mind there. But I'm wondering if maybe you can talk a little bit about your experience in your career pushing these ideas into the mainstream and kind of the attitudes that you've encountered along the way.
Well, one of the things that I've always tried to maintain a commitment to in my career is not running away from occult concepts or metaphysical concepts, using terms very freely like New Age or ESP or Satanism, you know, not trying to hide behind other more acceptable sounding vocabulary words, because I don't want us to cede ground to critics who might use a term like New Age, for example, as an insult, as a way of describing everything that's squishy or immature in the spiritual search. To me, New Age is just therapeutic spirituality. And to me, the occult just means a search for a hidden dimension of life whose forces are felt on us and through us. These terms have historical integrity. They have meaning. And I don't want to run away from them. I find, frankly, the impulse to disguise one's beliefs and to run away from one's beliefs sometimes within the neighborhood of our own alternative spiritual subculture, where people sometimes don't want to say psychic, they want to say intuitive, or they don't want to say ESP, they want to say psi research or something like that. They don't want to say occult, they want to say esoteric, they don't want to say New Age, they want to say comparative religion. But the thing is, we're going to get called these things anyway, and we should claim them for our own and not run away from them. You know, when I was a kid, my father told me that if a dog is coming after you, it's going to bite you worse if you run away from it. So, you know, don't run away. Stand up. Describe what you believe in, if only because it's the truth. And all we have is the truth, as a great man once said. And so I've found a lot more liberation and a lot more relaxation, frankly, in terms of pursuing my work when I'm very direct and I'm very upfront with people. So, for example, I'll use a term like positive thinking. I'm very aware that for some people, positive thinking has kind of a musty feel to it. You know, it seems to belong on my grandmother's nightstand or something like that. But if I create a more fancy term, and I can, like applied transcendentalism, you know, then people won't know what I'm talking about. And I want my Aunt Lois to know what I'm talking about. So I persist in using some of the old terms because not only are they truthful, not only do they have historical integrity, but they're plain and they're clear. And that in itself is a way of pushing back against cynicism. It only capitulates to cynicism if you agree to its terms and if you run away from phrases and ideas or identifications that are going to produce eye rolls in the cynics, then in a way, it almost validates cynicism. So I think we all need to be very plain and very earnest about what we're about and what we believe in.
It's fascinating. You say that. I've really found the same thing in that I've always used the word magic and just flat yes. out magic with a K, like just
right.
deal with it. Right.
Deal with it. Exactly.
And, but for a long time, I was very, you know, conflicted about that.
Yeah.
And people, and even people in the magic world were telling me, you know, like use a different word, figure out a way to repackage and reframe
yeah,
it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
yeah.
it never worked until I did basically what you're saying and was just like, look, this is it. They flat out. I'm not going to mask it or couch it because
yeah.
I also think that now that we have the internet, we don't need to worry about mainstream media gatekeepers.
Mm-hmm,
really.
Mm-hmm.
It's just no longer relevant.
Yeah.
The internet really seems to reward people clustering off into niches.
Yes.
So, yeah.
And it rewards bluntness because there, you know, there's so much sort of double talk in the culture today that I think when people experience bluntness and they experience a direct, straightforward message, like someone standing up and saying, yes, I believe in magic. I practice ceremonial magic or I practice chaos magic. You know, they're relieved that somebody's not selling them a bill of goods, but being very direct and very plain with them. I gave a talk recently in New York City called Satanism, the Dark Alternative, and it was an earnest, mature, adult
exploration. Yeah, I watched the video.
Yeah, and it's a topic I'm hugely interested at this time in my life. And in fact, this is a good time to mention the tragic and untimely death of Adam Parfrey, who I just learned died last night. And he was such a seminal force and figure in bringing satanic thought into the 21st century. And that influence is going to be greatly, greatly missed. And I'm so deeply grateful to him that he made the books available that he did, and you worked with Adam, of course, and books ranging from Anton LaVey's The Devil's Notebook to Lords of Chaos, which explored the black metal scene, have been so important and so helpful to me over the past year in developing my interest in these areas.
Yeah.
So a word of deep tribute must be said to Adam.
Yeah, absolutely. He was a great mentor.
And
supporter to me. And Adam was like an avatar of Loki.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Like he just loved to troll. And
yeah.
Before the internet. And
before the internet. He was the internet.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
He really was. He was the only source of that information.
That's right. And a lot of that information would have been a lot harder to find and to disseminate if it wasn't for his influence.
Yeah.
And he never masked anything. He never disguised anything. And that's inspiring to me.
Well, he loved to get a result. He loved to get a rise out of people.
He was a provocateur.
Yeah.
He was a provocateur. Now, I'm not a provocateur, but when I gave my talk recently in New York City on Satanism, there were people who pressured me to change the title of it even after the talk was cataloged and advertised because they felt the term is so maleficent and would convey the wrong message.
What do they want you to change it to?
Oh,
dark humanism?
Yeah, something like that. Right, right. Wouldn't that be lovely?
Right.
You know, the shadow side, finding the shadow.
Love that one.
And I wouldn't do that because my feeling is I am delivering a talk on Satanism. Deal with it. If you don't like it, you don't have to come. I'm not going to come to your house and bother you, you know, but you're welcome to come to my house for a night. And if you like it, stick around. If you don't like it, don't come back.
Right.
It's not forcing a set of ideas on anyone. It's just saying, let's sit down as partners in the exchange and have a conversation about this. And in doing that, I'm going to be very plain about what I'm serving and what I'm exploring. And so I feel very strongly that we have to use direct language. It's a blow against cynicism when we do that. In my case, not to be provocative, but just to be very plain. And frankly, it feels so much better. When I started using the term New Age and allowed to everyone that I freely define myself by that term, I don't run away from that term, it made everything so much easier. It just made everything so much easier, because 20 years ago, I might have run away from that term or been insulted by that term. But when I realized, look, it's going to get applied to me anyway, and the fact is, what's so bad about it? What's so bad about it? To me, New Age is therapeutic spirituality. It's a radical ecumenism. Right. I don't mind being defined by it. You know?
Well, let's talk about your new interest in Satanism, right? Because I saw online when you announced that you were going to take a left turn, as it were, and start exploring the dark arts, and people were triggered. I saw some people got very, especially I think, we used to call them, the white lighters. You know, they got very triggered by this.
Some people did. I've also made a lot of wonderful friends. I had an interesting experience. Probably about 10 years ago, I would have written off Anton LaVey and the Church of Satan as just an act of showmanship. But I was wrong. I was wrong about that. I read a book recently that I was very touched by called A Culture by Carl Abrahamson. Yep. And in A Culture, which is a wonderful book, Carl has a chapter on the life and work of Anton LaVey, the founder of the Church of Satan. And suddenly I had a whole new appreciation for Anton as a magician, as an artist, as an intellectual, as a provocateur of the best kind. I don't know what it was. Sometimes it's almost as if we're just waiting for something, because I don't know that I had been walking around thinking about any of this in any active or cognizant way, but when I read Carl's chapter, it was very affecting to me, and I realized that this man had deeper waters in his life than I had realized, and drinking from those waters provided me with a whole new experience. And I think it also, this interest also came along at a time when maybe I was worried that my own search was getting a little stale. Maybe I heard myself repeating things too much, repeating a template too much. And of course, I'm going to speak in about an hour and a half here at the Philosophical Research Society. And one of the things I want to talk about is the importance of our search never getting stale. I was also trying to come to terms with certain ideas within the positive mind world. There's a division within that world, as I think there is within all religion, whether we define it this way or not, between thy will be done and my will be done. Hmm. And I've come to feel that the human will is sacred. Aspiration is sacred. If we are created in the image of something higher, then we're here to produce. We're here to be generative. And Anton was so venerating of individual will, of the individual seeing through and carrying out his or her plans and sense of self-agency in the world, and that magic could figure into that, symbols could figure into that. And I was very aroused by his ideas, and I suddenly began to discover this kind of counter tradition that could be called satanic within Western culture. I began to read Genesis 3 differently and see the serpent not necessarily as a malevolent figure, but maybe as a liberating figure, as many of the romantic poets and some of the early feminists and suffragists saw the serpent. And I began to read things by Shelley and Byron and some of the other romantic figures, and see how they saw Satan, or the figure of Satan, or the allegory of Satan, as this great rebel, this great disruptor of conformity, this great challenger, this force that extolled human agency. And that's where my search took me. I never could have imagined that.
Interesting.
But that's where my search took me.
So I'm curious about this. Certainly the idea of the will and the true will, it was very much brought forth through Crowley.
Yeah.
And sure. I think that Crowley probably through his own experiments probably came to the conclusion that it wasn't really that different from the universal will. I think that's what the lemma was driving towards. But yeah. I'm curious about, because it seems like you've gone into this, which, you know, impressively so, very sincerely and scientifically. And, you know, I've tried in my life to explore everything. And I spent a lot of time going through Satanism. I spent a lot of time going through the Temple of Set's work.
Oh, yeah. I admire Aquino enormously.
All of that. But yeah. I will say, I was particularly with the Temple of Set, the philosophical stuff was impressive, the focus on Plato, mm-hmm. all that. But I will say, I didn't really find, at least what it, you know, just on the surface at least, I didn't really find anything like working magical technology. I didn't find any techniques for entering altered states. I didn't find any real rituals outside of kind of antinomian deconditioning rituals.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then, you know, some curse rituals, you know, which always backfires. And then, LaVey's garble, the Nokian. And
mm-hmm.
so
right,
I don't know,
right, right.
has that, have you found anything, you know, workable or operational in that material?
I am more inspired by Michael Aquino as an intellectual and literary figure. I admire Aquino's writings enormously, particularly the Diabolicon and the Book of Coming Forth by Night. I have no desire right now to join any magical or initiatory order for the
Just to make that clear, I didn't join any of these things.
Got
I
you.
Mean, I went through their corpus of written material.
Got you, so. Got you. Yeah. I'm more of an advocate of what I call anarchic magic. I think we need to be nomads. I think we need to search on our own. If an organization or a lodge or a congregation meets somebody's needs, then I applaud that, and I'm glad to hear that they found something. I don't really mesh well with congregational spirituality, with hierarchical spirituality, with initiatory organizations. I'm writing quite a bit right now at medium.com about magical methods and ideas. I just completed a 10-article series there called Real Magic. And in that series, I outline some of the things that I have personally found effective, and I'll talk about some of them tonight. One of the things that I've been experimenting with recently that I actually think is very effective is that I think we all have some kind of a doppelganger or a double. It may not appear to us as an actual physical pulsating entity, but it's real nonetheless. Sometimes it's referred to as a plus entity or a minus entity. I think this is actually a real thing that we face in life. And if we, on a really totalizing level, encompassing of emotion, encompassing of intellect, wish to find this plus entity, I think the individual will find something. I really do.
I've been
experimenting with that.
Do you mean this in the sense of an astral doppelganger? Do you mean this in the sense of a reverse of your personality within your own personality framework? Do you mean it in the sense of like the holy guardian angel?
I probably mean it more in the sense of an astral doppelganger. Although one could also look at it as a metaphor. I think that we all have the sense that there's two of us within, that there are twins like a Jacob and an Esau kind of fighting for dominance. One tends to be more passive, the other tends to be more active, effective, assertive, capable. I think we all feel that tension within us. You could look at this as a psychological metaphor, although I think it's something more than that. As somebody who takes seriously an extra physical dimension to life, I think that our metaphors give name and give shape to non-physical qualities and principles that we're not always able to get our arms around in a precise way. So, for example, your phrase astral doppelganger, I'm sympathetic to that, although I would say that if a person just wants to use this idea as a psychological metaphor, he can do that too.
So it sounds like you're talking more about the two sides of the personality,
yeah.
the light and dark side.
But as an actual thing, as an actual choice.
What do you think of the concept of the dweller on the threshold from Theosophy?
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting concept. I mean, all of these things are in the same neighborhood. You know, Jung's description of the shadow is in the same neighborhood. There have been writers, you know, from Rudolf Steiner to O. Henry, who've talked about this idea of feeling that there's dual forces battling within them and that we face these choices. I think these things are all part of the same neighborhood, all part of the same discussion. There was a piece of self-help literature, very, very little known by a writer named Von Rensselaer Day, published in 1900 called A Magic Tale. And it was the story of a craftsman from the 17th century who encountered his plus entity, his more effective, more powerful, more capable twin, so to speak. And as soon as he gave his life over to this more capable twin, he became effective. He became possessed of abilities that had dwelt latently within him, but that he had never been able to access. And I think that story captured something actually true. And I've been experimenting with that lately. So that's what I've been rocking to very lately.
Interesting. Yeah. So yeah, my primary interest in, you know, Satanism, I think, is, you know, I've never been a Satanist or consider myself a Satanist, but my interest in certainly the left-hand path, which for me, you know, I went through a very intense period in my life in my late 20s where I immersed myself in the darkest stuff I could get my hands on. Mm-hmm. In my case, it was Agora, left-hand path tantra from India. It was the Cliff Hoth and the Kenneth Grant Typhonian tradition. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, very quickly started to unravel myself.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. And, but the interesting thing about these things for me was that I approached them from the language of kind of what you're saying. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to, because as a magical person, right, as somebody who, you know, in your case, very sincerely wants to explore all aspects of consciousness,
yep,
most people close the door on that.
Yes.
And then it emerges without their consent and
right,
screws up their life. So you want to get at least on friendly terms with it, right? The dark side of yourself.
Well, you know, I view the dark side as not necessarily maleficent, but darkness can be the womb. As Aquino puts it, if it wasn't for darkness, we wouldn't see the stars at night with the naked eyes. Darkness can be this place of great gestation, and it can also be a place of power. And, you know, I've written recently on this. There's an article that I wrote at Medium called The Devil's Reading List, where I try to survey some of the literature from biblical antiquity up through some of the romantic literature and some modern expressions in Western life that look at this question of whether we can make a different reading of the satanic, of the Luciferian, that maybe there are these different forces in life, these different creative forces, and what has traditionally been referred to as God could be one of stasis and passivity, and what has traditionally been referred to as Satan could be one of nonconformity and activity and a kind of upsetting of norms. And I put the challenge to people that maybe you can offer a prayer or an appeal or a petition to this countervailing force that we have metaphorically named Satan or Lucifer or the dark side, and that it is a force of upsetting of norms, of nonconformity. In Vedic tradition, people might sometimes call it Shiva, but I tend to deal more with Western tradition in my life, just because I suppose that's where my proclivities are. And I believe very strongly that there are non-physical forces to which one can appeal or pray or petition, and a person could attempt to cultivate a relationship with that so-called dark side, with the metaphorical Satan, which could be seen as a force of rebellion, of countervailing power, of upsetting of conformity, of passion. And I take that very seriously. It's my own personal search. I offer it to people for experiment. They can try it. It's been positive for me.
It's interesting you bring up Hinduism, and I certainly, you know, Shiva in Hinduism is in many times the destroyer,
yeah,
but is God, is not the rebel.
Right.
Right. So
right.
I'm not sure it would be I'll say this. I'm not sure I don't think there's a one-to-one correspondence metaphysically at all. Right. However, it's pretty clear you can see Shiva with the trident, and some of the images of Satan,
yeah,
or the trishul, some of the images of Satan in Western culture may be propaganda images against the Hindu god. Now, that said, the conclusion that I came to with Satanism and the Western esoteric tradition is it wasn't rebellious enough.
Mm.
And what I mean by that is that, and I write about this a lot in the John Dee book that I just wrote, is that it's a part of the Christian tradition.
Mm-hmm.
It's a part of the Judeo-Christian tradition, which is very, has a lot of issues that go with it. Mm-hmm. And the conclusion that I came to was you can't rebel against the popularity of Star Wars by putting on a Darth Vader mask.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So for me, I just totally scrapped the entire thing and mm-hmm. went straight into Hindu Tantra
mm-hmm.
as a way of deconditioning consciousness and just mm-hmm. saying, you know, I don't want to be playing. If, you know, if I switch sides, I'm still playing the same game.
Mm. Yeah, I see what you're saying. I suppose my approach is that in human life, we have written down all kinds of parables and allegory and mythology, and I don't necessarily look upon any of those parables and sacred texts as having dominance or being an urtext. I read very broadly across all of them. I guess that's why I take what might loosely be called an anarchic approach. I don't identify scripture as a kind of urtext necessarily. I view it as a repository of extremely important parables, maybe pieces of history, allegory, pieces of insight. I also would say that the corpus of Hellenic myths is the same thing. I would also say there's certain modern literature that represents that. So I read very broadly across these different fields so that I don't feel that I'm just playing Darth Vader to Yoda, you know, so to speak. Or sometimes, you know, Yoda may have it absolutely right. And I pick among different myths and parables and ideas that I think have transcendental gravity and weight and greatness and truthfulness. So I don't feel like I'm necessarily playing for or against any team so much as I'm just selecting among what is out there that I personally feel right. is forwarding of my search.
Well, that's the whole idea with chaos magic, right?
Yes.
If you go through all these things
very
and
deeply.
You
yeah.
find that you, and that's the approach that I've taken where I've gone through tradition after tradition after tradition. And I've really made an effort not to get stuck by any one, but to
yeah.
take them all seriously and
yeah.
get, well, as you said, you know, advance my own path as much as I can within those structures, but
yes.
not get stuck in any one.
Yeah,
but,
I think that's
but
right.
I do think, but I am interested in, you know, I do think it's disingenuous when people just ignore the dark parts.
Yeah.
Right? Because you can't ignore, if you ignore the dark parts of yourself, you're in trouble.
You're in a
right?
lot of trouble. And they may be just what you need. They may come to your rescue at a certain moment. You know, there may be a certain moment where you need to run towards something rather than run away from something. And at that pivotal moment, the so-called dark half of you may be just what is called upon. It may
right.
be self-preserving.
I think it was Anton LaVey, or, you know, I think that, but certainly with the dark paths in the 60s and 70s, they really were making a very accurate critique of a lot of the kind of hippie paths and the white light paths where people
yeah.
are just kind of sitting there, you know, saying, oh, I'm overcoming my ego and waiting for things to work out. It's like,
right.
well, why don't you just go over and, you know, get the job and do the thing that you want to do, get the girl, turn the knob on the door yourself instead of waiting for some cosmic force to do it for you.
Right.
And
right.
I think that's one of the
point.
One of LaVey's insights. Right?
And
that's pretty good.
I think that's right on. And something that I found in Anton's work that really spoke to me, that's very closely related to what you were just saying, is that he felt that there was such a deep-seated hypocrisy in religion, both in its traditional and alternative variants, insofar as you have people who are looking for things, who want things, who have unfulfilled needs and desires, many of them very legitimate and very necessary, and they might be seeking these things in a variety of ways, sometimes through prayer, sometimes through visualization, sometimes through affirmation, all kinds of different methods through which they're trying to spiritually seek fulfillment. And yet at the same time, they're clinging to this idea of the dissolution of the ego, of thy will be done, thy will be done. And he felt that the white light path, so to speak, was one of total hypocrisy because the individual is actually campaigning for something, but just saying, but only if you want it, to whatever the higher power is, only if you want it. And it's almost like you're trying to trick yourself and the powers that be into saying, you know, I really want this and I really need this, but only if you will it, only if you will it, and please will it, because why else would you be making the petition? What's the point of a petition if you're not putting your needs out there? And Anton felt it was at cross purposes, and it was ultimately hypocritical. And I think he's right, which is why in the field of new thought and positive thinking and mind metaphysics, and I'll be talking about this tonight, I feel that you have to just really decide what team you're playing for. Is it thy will be done?
Are there
or
teams
will be
though?
Done? Yeah.
That's
are there question. Teams?
Are there, you know, what teams are
I'm
there?
Speaking figuratively, but what I really mean to say is that I believe that individual aspiration is sacred, is right, is natural, is great, is holy, if I can put it that way.
Yeah.
And I think people should be unembarrassed about it.
It's a healthier psychological perspective.
It has been for me.
Yeah.
It has been for me.
But it's interesting because I feel like just with this conversation, we're butting up on some cultural conditioning on two sides here. And I think that, I was thinking on the way over here to have the conversation of the critiques of not just magic, but also new thought and positive thinking from the different sides of the political spectrum, where the critique from the right is very, you know, Jack Chick, very clear, like, oh, well, you're going to go down the dark path and become a pawn of Satan, right? Which we've been talking about.
I'm working on it. Yeah.
And on the other side, I think the left-wing critique, which I think you've had some interesting thoughts about, is always that, you know, it becomes solipsistic, you know, especially with a lot of the new thought stuff, which we just saw, for instance, with the controversy around Tony Robbins, right?
Yeah.
Where
yeah.
it's kind of like, well, you know, it's very easy to fall into a reality tunnel with magical thinking, where A, you're not attributing the causes for the things in your life to anything external to you, where you're not looking at structural problems in society, where it can very easily even become victim blaming, which I've seen a lot in it kind of, you know,
Definitely.
New age thinking, where it's like,
That's real.
If there's anything's been going bad in your life, it's got to be your fault because you manifested.
Right. And I break with that very sharply.
So I'm curious, and I know that you've talked about Marxist forms of new thought, right? So I'm sure you've got some interesting thoughts on kind of the cultural critique on both sides of this, right?
Right. Now, I've been writing about Marx, about Ayn Rand, about Satanism, about positive thinking.
You're just hitting all the edgy topics.
I want to make certain that everyone hates me. I have no neighborhood to dwell in. But look, the fact is, I do think that you find insights within all these areas. I mean, I love the assertion of self that you find within Ayn Rand, but I also love within Marx the critique of a capitalist system that I think actually does create an underclass. I believe in those economic forces. You know, Marx didn't come up with a solution, but he came up with a critique. And some people within the New Thought world have attempted to weave Marxist thought within their ideology. Some people lean more in the direction of Rand. And I find truth in both those neighborhoods, and whether there's a contradiction there, it doesn't matter to me because there's truth there. And whether there's a bridge is my search. You know, that's what I'm looking for. Ultimately, the question of all that all these ideas have to stand in front of is, do they work? Do they work? Every individual, all of your viewers and listeners, have within their lives some burning thing that they want, some problem that they're trying to solve, some addiction that they're trying to recover from, you know, something that they need to get done in this world. And I believe very strongly in William James's principle that philosophy has to have a cash value in day-to-day life, however you define that. And so, you know, that's my search. I don't know if I'm directly addressing your question, but I believe that all these areas that we've been talking about are areas in which people are trying to find a sense of human agency. And I feel driven to search very deeply in all these places, not to exclude any of them. And I think you're right that the exclusion of these things might mean the neglect of the very thing that a person needs in his or her life at a given moment.
Yeah, I really appreciate the Catholicness, if you will, of your search.
I appreciate that term. Yeah.
But not in the church sense.
Right.
But one thing that, you know, while you were just talking there, it was occurring to me, and that it's been amazing for me personally to realize how, you know, I, at this point, you know, after 20 years, consider magic to be really a spontaneously emergent principle of human life, of consciousness, right? And it cuts across all political spectrums. It cuts across all, you know, race, gender, class boundaries, it seems. And, but one thing that I want to talk about with your work with Occult America is, you know, you really bring out in that book how fundamental these ideas have been to America. And so when I was doing John Dee and the Empire of Angels, you know,
which is a great book, by the way.
Thank you.
I have to tell you, you just have created an epic work. I don't think that anything is going to surpass that study of John Dee as an occultist.
Thank you, Mitch. And thank you for the quote for it. It was a huge help.
From the heart. Yeah.
And so in the research of this book, it really, you know, the shocking and amazing thing that came out of it was that, you know, all of the ideals of Rosicrucianism that had been put together partly from Dee's work and emerged in Bohemia and Prague and Central Europe in the, you know, 1600s and went into the Rosicrucian manifestos, then went into Bacon's New Atlantis, and how much America was an alchemical experiment to try and, in the same way that Los Angeles is an alchemical experiment, to say, how can we create a society that is intellectually and spiritually free and that people can engage with these ideas and enlightenment and human betterment on their own terms? And it seems to me that, you know, your book Occult America, you know, is the, you know, the master course in this stuff. So I'm wondering if you can talk a bit about how those ideas came out of, maybe made the leap across the Atlantic and kind of the occult background of America a little bit. And we don't have a whole lot of time left.
Right.
But, yeah.
Well, you know, you had, of course, this occult flowering in Europe during the age of the Renaissance. And as always happens, there was a period of backlash where church authority reasserted itself. And part of the result of that backlash was what we call the 30 Years' War, which began in 1618. It, you know, loosely speaking, it pitted Catholic armies against Protestant armies. And there were many different causes, but part of it was the Reformation and these radical expressions of religious experimentalism, which church states wanted to oppose. And the area of Central Europe that had been so rich in religious experimentation, from the Rhine Valley in the west to Bohemia in the east, was devastated by the 30 Years' War, and that devastation persisted for generations afterward. And at the same time, new settlements were cropping up in the so-called New World of America, and word trickled across the Atlantic that there was a reasonable amount of religious freedom in the New World, and certain religious radicals, for reasons of their own, and not just commerce, made the very dangerous trip across the Atlantic. Some made it, and little colonies sprouted up around Philadelphia and Pennsylvania and New England. One of the chief ones was founded by Johann Kelpius in the 1690s on the Wissahickon Creek outside of Philadelphia. He was succeeded by Conrad Beisel, who founded the community of Ephrata in Pennsylvania. Mystical, occult-themed, radically experimental Christian communities. And people knew about these places and visited these places. And generation or so later, Mother Ann Lee and her small band of Shakers fled persecution in Manchester, England, and started their first colony in the Hudson Valley outside of Albany in the year 1775. And people became aware that these little religious communes could exist without harassment, which was extraordinary, you know, coming from a Europe where, you know, the Cathars and other offshoot groups had been massacred, had been subjected to the Inquisition. Sometimes radical groups and religious radicals were protected by a beneficent leader like a Queen Elizabeth, but after her death, you know, there was a reversal of some of this religious toleration. And the New World provided something of an exception to that, which was extraordinary because you had slavery going on and you had the destruction of the Native American culture going on. But concurrent with that, you had a relative degree of religious toleration. And religious radicals made the extremely dangerous voyage in some cases across the Atlantic, and Shaker villages expanded and other communal experiments expanded, particularly in upstate New York, in the region that was known as the Burned Over District after the War of Independence. And for the first 30 years or so, 30, 40, 50 years of the 19th century, this snake of land in upstate New York that was maybe about 20 miles wide, that extended from Albany to Buffalo, maybe about 350 miles or so, became kind of the launching pad for everything that was radical and new in religious and social ideas, because it was newly settled territory, just like California was in the early 20th century. It was newly settled territory. Wherever there are new population flows, you will always find the upcropping of new religious movements. So the Burned Over District gave birth to Mormonism, Seventh-day Adventism, various strands of utopianism, the suffragist movement, the spiritualist movement, both of which grew up together in this region of incredibly fertile farmland that doesn't seem like a bohemia of the New World. You can drive through it today, and it still is largely untouched farmland, very beautiful. And it's hard to believe that this strip of land was home to all these religious and social revolutionary movements that fanned out across America. But it was newly settled land. And the reason it gained the name the Burned Over District, at least according to legend, is one itinerant minister said to another, "Oh, you know, don't bother trying to convert people there. That place has been burned over," which meant, you know, everybody belonged to something. Everybody belonged to some church or sect or club or congregation or something like that. And
sounds like LA.
Yeah, it sounds like LA. And it was LA. You know, I mean, LA is the Burned Over District of the 20th and 21st century. And there were all kinds of different mediums and spirit channelers. Sometimes they went by different names than that, who gathered little congregations around them and took on the mantle of prophet. And the Burned Over District was called by one historian a psychic highway. It was a road leading from east to west across New York State, but it also became the road that religious revolutionaries like a Joseph Smith traveled out west, you know, spreading their ideas or relocating.
He was very steeped in the occult, right?
Which you talk about in your book. Occult. And you know, the general congregation of Mormons in this country, I think, are very interested in Smith's background in the occult. The church fathers in Salt Lake City won't have any of it, but Mormonism has a very well-read congregation. I have in-laws who are Mormon, and they're deeply interested in Smith's occult roots and his interest in astrology and folklore and ways in which the folklore of the Burned Over District figure into the Book of Mormon. Depending on your perspective, you could say, well, you know, that's an actual accurate representation of history, or you could say that Joseph Smith was just clipping and pasting local folklore that he turned into a new religious scripture. Either, you know, Smith pirated folklore, or folklore was just a pale representation of the actual truth that Smith brought in the Book of Mormon. But what isn't contestable is that Smith was deeply interested in Freemasonry and astrology. These things ran through the Smith home. He was wearing a silver medallion with an astrological sigil of Jupiter around his neck at the time he died, which was something that was seen as a symbol of good luck and strength in the Smith household. And these things are an indelible part of our lives. You know, the Burned Over District was the Mount Sinai of American religion in many respects. And it created movements that fanned out across our country and that made America in many regards into a laboratory of religious experimentation. America's first exports in terms of ideas were really spiritualism, seances, mental healing. You know, these things cropped up in the salons of London and Paris after they were formulated in the log cabins of Ohio and Kentucky.
That's not what they tell you when you hang out in the occult world in London.
Yeah, well, they don't always know their own history, because table rapping and seances and so forth, you know, in their modern iteration, had their launch in upstate New York before they started to appear as spiritualism or spiritism, as it was sometimes called, in London and Paris.
That's incredible. Well, while we're on the dark arts, one question. Donald Trump, right? So the other day I was in the library and I was going through some of Donald Trump's books, and they were full of references to Carl Jung and positive thinking and all of this stuff. So I'm curious if you have an opinion on the dark one himself.
Well, Trump talks about reading the book, The Power of Positive Thinking, the great book on positive mind metaphysics written by Norman Vincent Peale, which put the phrase on the map in the 1950s. It's one of the only books Trump ever talks about reading. It obviously was an influence on him. His family has deep roots at Marble Collegiate Church on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan, which was Norman Vincent Peale's pulpit for many decades. Peale performed many the ceremonies of many of Trump's failed marriages, and we have a president who seems to have embraced mind metaphysics as a way of life, which puts me in front of a very deep question, because I could come up with a glib answer and say, oh, well, you know, Trump is just the mad Frankenstein monster of positive mind philosophy, and come up with all kinds of excuses as to why, you know, he's run away with a perfectly good ethical philosophy. Or I could take a braver position, which is what I try to take, and say, is there something in this philosophy that is morally vacuous, that produces a Donald Trump, that gives you a sense of magic, a sense of power without any grounding in ethics? It's a kind of ethical solipsism, and has that contributed to the Trump phenomenon? And I kind of try to hold that as a question, because if I answer that too quickly, I'm liable to just explain away Trump and not ask myself questions about whether the movement that I've dedicated myself to has some serious ethical questions to ask itself, since our current poster boy and our most successful acolyte is currently the president of the United States. You know, if it was Obama, everybody in the positive mind community, myself included, would be celebrating the fact that he read The Power of Positive Thinking, and we'd be putting out, you know, special Obama inaugural editions of New Thought books. But instead, it's Trump, which seems to embarrass a lot of people. And again, it puts me in front of a serious ethical question, and it's one that I really want to sit with.
Well, Mitch, lots of brave positions. I wish we could keep talking, but we got to wrap up. I, of course, recommend your books to all of the people listening to this and watching this. It's, you know, they're the most among the most important and critical ones out there right now. You're one of the most important people writing about the topic.
Thank you.
And definitely pick up your books. So where can people do that? Where can people find out more about you?
Well, if you throw my name into Google, it'll take you to my website, MitchHorowitz.com. Lots of links there, different articles. If you go to Medium, I have series of different articles that you can find there, including Real Magic, which has a lot of practical ideas. And I have a new book coming out called The Miracle Club, which is about positive mind metaphysics and a number of the things that we've been talking about. That's coming out from Inner Traditions in October, and it can be pre-ordered anywhere you buy books.
All right, Mitch, it was a great conversation.
Thank you. A pleasure.
All right, talk to you soon.
All right.